Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Today's conference is being recorded. If there are any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'd like to introduce your host for today's conference, Ms. Linda Feinberg. Ms. Feinberg, you may begin.
Thank you very much. Hello, I'm Linda Feinberg, President of FINRA Dispute Resolution, and I'm delighted to welcome the over 1,400 neutrals who have called in to today's program. Today's call will last about 1.25 hours. First, I will briefly cover several developments of interest to arbitrators, discuss case statistics and filing trends, and note again the importance of filing uniform submission agreements. The majority of our program will consist of a panel discussion on three topics: investor education, emerging regulatory issues, and future case trends. Now for some current events. As many of you have read, on October 6th, we will launch a 2-year pilot program that will allow investors in a set number of cases to choose a panel of 3 public arbitrators instead of 2 public arbitrators and 1 non-public arbitrator. 11 firms have volunteered to participate in the pilot program, and others may still join. The firms have agreed to contribute 10 to 40 cases each year for a 2-year period. Over the course of 2 years, over 550 arbitration cases will be eligible for the pilot. The participating firms, all of which have volunteered, represent a range of firm sizes and business models. Only the investor can elect to participate in the pilot program. The firms will not decide which cases become part of the pilot. The pilot will be available for eligible claims received by FINRA on or after October 6, 2008. We believe that this pilot will allow us to evaluate whether a change in the way arbitration panels are selected is a better way to serve and protect investors' interests. Now a word on how these cases will be selected. Investors with claims involving participating firms will opt into the pilot on a first-in basis. Investors in cases received on or after October 6, naming only a participating firm in which the parties are entitled to a 3-person panel, may elect to proceed in the pilot program. Investors may elect to participate in their statement of claim or any accompanying documentation. For all other cases, FINRA will send a letter to investors' representatives or pro se parties outlining the pilot details. You can find out much more about the pilot by visiting our website, www.finra.org, and clicking on the Arbitration and Mediation tab on the lower left side. A detailed FAQ is at the site under Update. A word to non-public arbitrators who have expressed some concern about the pilot. These arbitrators are concerned that they will not continue or be able to continue to participate in the forum. That is simply not the case. First of all, parties, even those in the pilot, remain free to retain and rank non-public arbitrators, even if they have elected to be in the pilot program. Therefore, some pilot cases may proceed with a non-public arbitrator. Also, the pilot does not affect intra-industry cases, which are a significant part of our caseload. Offices often as much as 1/3 of our cases. And, of course, the numbers in the pilot, although large, are still not as much as 50% of the cases in the forum, so that there will still be many cases that will be paneled with the regular 3-person panel. That is 2 public and 1 non-public arbitrator. So we still very much need to have the services that are rendered to the FINRA forum by non-public arbitrators. Now, next, some information on auction rate securities cases. On August 7, we announced a change in how we appoint arbitrators in auction rate securities cases, Now, these are the auction rate securities cases that are not the group of cases for consequential damages that will result from regulatory settlements. More about them in a moment. In auction rate securities cases with a three-person panel of arbitrators, none of the non-public arbitrators may be affiliated with firms that have recently sold auction rate securities. However, the arbitration panels in those cases will continue to consist of two public arbitrators and one non-public arbitrator. To support these special procedures, we surveyed our non-public arbitrators to determine if they had sold auction rate securities, supervised employees who had sold them, or worked for a firm that sold them since January 1, 2005. We also reviewed internal FINRA data. Non-public arbitrators cannot serve on an auction rate securities case if since January 1, 2005, they have auction rate securities experience or failed to respond to the survey but worked at a securities firm, or have worked at a firm that FINRA has identified as having sold auction rate securities. To any of you out there who have not replied to the survey, you should reply as soon as possible. If we do not hear from you, we are assuming that you cannot participate in auction rate securities cases and you will not appear on any of the lists that are sent to the parties in those cases. In addition, as I'm sure you've all been following in the newspapers, the Securities and Exchange Commission, FINRA, and a number of the states are entering into regulatory settlements with numerous firms, pursuant to which the firms will buy back auction rate securities from certain classes of investors. The regulators must finalize and approve the terms of the settlements. Under these settlements, if a customer has incurred consequential damages, the customer may elect to participate in a special arbitration process. This process will be administered by FINRA, and a single public arbitrator will hear the claim. In this special process, the firms cannot contest liability for misrepresentations and omissions, but may challenge the existence or amount of any consequential damages. As the procedures are developed for these cases, we will post them on our website, but we cannot do so until the securities firms conclude their agreements with their regulators. So please be patient. Now a word about our case filings and trends. As you all know, for several years, FINRA's case filings have steadily declined. Many of you were concerned that you were not being asked to serve on cases. That, however, is changing remarkably this year. We are, of course, counter-cyclical in our arbitration caseload to the market. When the Dow and S&P go up, our caseload goes down. When the Dow and the S&P go down, our caseload goes up. Through mid-September of this year, we have experienced a 39% increase in total cases compared to the same period in 2007, and a 67% increase in customer cases. Cases involving subprime mortgages and auction rate securities account for a large part of this increase. From January 1 of this year to mid-September, FINRA received 493 cases involving subprime mortgage securities and 234 cases involving auction rate securities. Before I introduce our guests, I want to mention the importance of uniform submission agreements. As you know, claimants are required to sign a uniform submission agreement before FINRA will process a claim. Firms and associated persons are required to submit a signed USA with their answers. Unfortunately, we continue to find that some firms and associated persons named as respondents fail to submit their uniform submission agreement. This is not a new problem. As stated in our regulatory notice 04-11, issued over 4 years ago, a party's failure to sign and submit the USA may cause confusion, lead to ancillary litigation, and undermine the enforceability of arbitration awards. When parties move to confirm their awards in court, for example, the applicable statute normally requires that parties attach to the motion their agreement to arbitrate. Our initial pre-hearing script requires arbitrators to remind parties to submit USAs and to notify parties that the arbitrators may impose sanctions. For example, monetary sanctions or an award of attorney's fees for the failure of parties to submit the USAs absent a specific jurisdictional challenge. We urge you to take action against parties that fail to comply with this fundamental rule. If we continue to see that respondents are failing to submit the Uniform Commission Agreement, we will make referrals to the enforcement arm of FINRA and ask FINRA to take enforcement action against firms that routinely decline to sign a USA. And now I'm delighted to introduce our special panel for today. Laura Gansler is Associate Vice President in FINRA's Office of Emerging Regulatory Issues. Laura had previously worked with us in FINRA Dispute Resolution and also in FINRA's Office of General Counsel. Before joining FINRA, she was a staff member of the Securities and Exchange Commission and also was in private practice. John Gannon is Senior Vice President for Investor Education at FINRA. He is responsible for the development and operation of our investor education program. He also serves as president of the FINRA Investor Education Foundation, where he manages the foundation's grant making. Before assuming his present duties, he was deputy director of the SEC's Office of Investor Education and Assistance. Laura, I'm going to start off with you and ask you if you can tell us what FINRA's Department of Emerging Regulatory Issues does. I think most people are not familiar with it.
Well, the department was started in 2002, and our goals are really threefold. First, to gather, analyze, and share regulatory intelligence within FINRA. Second, to identify and address emerging regulatory issues. And third, to coordinate policy throughout FINRA.
And John, what does the Department of Investor Education do? I also think that many of our arbitrators are not familiar with that.
We take a multi-pronged approach to reaching and educating investors. At the more traditional end of the spectrum, we've issued 11 new investor alerts so far this year. That's a record for us. And we've created new tools, bylined articles that get dropped into publications, and dozens of pages of new content for investors on finra.org. We provide investors with objective and unbiased educational resources that they can use to protect themselves. One of our newest resources is a new series of podcasts available on the FINRA website and on iTunes. You just need to simply download a podcast to your computer, iPod, or other MP3 player to listen whenever and wherever you choose. The first three podcasts of the series are on protecting your online brokerage account, reverse mortgages, and putting too much company stock in your 401k.
Now, I would point out to our arbitrators that these tools that are on the FINRA website are also very useful for arbitrators. They provide a lot of information to investors generally, but also information that you might find valuable as you hear the new kinds of cases that we're receiving. And Laura, one of the cases, as I mentioned, relates to subprime issues. Can you tell us a little bit about what these issues involved, which, as I said, we have almost 500 cases relating to subprime mortgages?
Sure. During the housing boom of the late 1990s, really through around 2006, lenders extended mortgages to people with risky credit histories, and that's called the subprime market. There were really three types of loans to the subprime borrowers that were most common. The first were loans of 100% of the property value. The second were no income verification loans, and the third were loans with low teaser interest rates. These loans were then flipped after closing, and brokerage firms bought them. Then they aggregated them together and securitized them as what's called CDOs, which are collateralized debt obligations, or CMOs, which are collateralized mortgage obligations. The firm sold these products to investors, and touted them as safe investments that were backed by mortgages, and that would return interest rates higher than money market funds or T-bills. But the housing market, as we all know, declined, and so did the value of the underlying properties. And at the same time, many of the low teaser rates expired, and the mortgages reset interest rates to market rates. As a result, many of the mortgage holders began defaulting on their mortgages. And the mutual funds and pensions that were heavily concentrated in CMOs and CDOs lost money. So this has all led to arbitration claims based on unsuitability and over-concentration in those CMOs and CDOs.
Let me just note that by describing these issues, we're not taking any position on particular cases. Those cases are really for you as arbitrators to determine as to whether or not there is any liability on the part of a brokerage firm or an individual broker. What we were doing here was just describing the phenomenon, which we describe on our website and, of course, has been the subject of many newspaper articles. Laura, I guess as a result of the work that you do, FINRA takes regulatory initiatives in a number of areas. Could you describe some of those for us?
Excuse me again. Yes, one of the areas that we've focused most heavily on in recent last year or two involves senior investors. As there have been a lot of publicity about the fact that the American population is aging rapidly, and FINRA is doing a lot of things to protect senior investors. From a regulatory perspective, we are focusing on the sale of unsuitable products to individual seniors. No product is per se unsuitable due to an investor's age, but investors' time horizons, their risk tolerance, their tax status, and other factors may change as they age. So we are paying particularly close attention to the suitability of products that are aimed at or marketed primarily to seniors. An example of this is life settlements, which is life settlements refer to the resale of an existing insurance policy to a third party. And life settlements involving variable life insurance policies are securities and therefore fall within our jurisdiction. The life settlement market is somewhat similar to the viatical market, but the policyholder selling the policy doesn't have to be terminally ill. In most cases, life settlements, in some cases, I should say, life settlements can be a valuable source of liquidity if the only other choice that the insurance holder has is to surrender the policy or let it lapse. But life settlements are complicated, the market is opaque, and we want investors to consider all of their alternatives. Broker-dealers recommending variable life settlements need to make sure that they're suitable for the customers that they're recommending them to, and they also are subject to best execution obligations. We are also looking closely at sales practices aimed at seniors. One of these sales practices that we're paying particularly close attention to is the use of professional or senior designations, such as certified senior specialist or retirement expert. Often these labels are used as a marketing ploy, but do not represent any real expertise or legitimate credentials. Some are, for example, just credentials you can buy off the Internet. But our research shows that in many cases, people are more likely to trust reps with such credentials. FINRA rules prohibit the misleading communications with the public, including the misleading use of professional designations. Our recent regulatory notice 0743 reminded firms that using any title or designation that conveys an expertise in senior investments or retirement planning where there is no such expertise could cause the firms to face enforcement action. And finally, another issue of concern regarding seniors is early retirement scams, where promoters go to a company and urge employees to withdraw their retirement funds early, making what's called 72T withdrawals, and reinvesting the funds in supposedly higher-yielding investments or strategies. The problem is that the higher-yielding investments are often much riskier. We recently issued tips to spot early retirement scams that tell human resource professionals and unions to check that the person who wants to talk to their employees is properly qualified to do that, to talk about early retirement issues, and that the company should confirm that the speaker has obtained all necessary approvals from his or her company to offer the early retirement seminar, and that the seminar and other sales materials have been approved as required. And they should review the seminar materials, including the handouts, slides, and speaker notes, to identify red flags, and refer seminar materials to FINRA if they are not comfortable with what they see.
Thank you. We expect, for those of you serving as arbitrators, that you will see a range of these kinds of issues over the next couple of years, given our baby boomer population. Emerging regulatory issues works hand in hand with investor education as we try and have our investor education related to what it is we're observing in the marketplace. So, John, what are some of Investor Ed's more recent initiatives?
I mean, you're absolutely right, Linda. We work very closely with Laura's group to try to provide investors with useful information. And we usually do this through our investor alerts, which provide information for investors about how to protect their money. To view our latest investor alerts, investors can go to our website, www.finra.org, then to the investor information section, and then to investor alerts. Another thing that arbitrators can do if they're interested in subscribing to our alerts is signing up for our email newsletter called Investor News by clicking on the subscriptions link at the top of any of the investor information pages. And anytime we issue a new investor alert, you'll be one of the first to receive it. As I've already mentioned, we've issued 11 investor alerts this year. Some of the ones that we've more recently issued involve reverse mortgages, auction rate securities, catastrophic bonds or CAT bonds, and 401k debit cards. You know, with respect to CAT bonds and auction rate securities, these are similar to CMOs in that they typically offer higher yield investment options for investors. And, you know, oftentimes we see investors chasing yield. So, I mean, those are some of the alerts that we've done recently.
And interestingly, we were able to get out some alerts really quickly with respect to what customers should do to protect their accounts in the face of either SIPC liquidation or bankruptcy. So we've really developed a facility to get that information out very quickly. John, maybe you want to talk to us a little bit about reverse mortgages and what the issues are there. I know we have put out an alert on those as well.
Right. Well, reverse mortgages is a tool that allows older Americans or older investors to tap into what is typically one of their largest assets, their home. But unfortunately, people don't always understand what the fees and expenses involved with reverse mortgages are or some of the risks they may be undertaking by investing in a reverse mortgage. So what our investor alert attempts to do is go through in detail how a reverse mortgage works, what the risks are to the consumer or the investor, and some tips to look at to make sure that you understand that the different expenses that are involved with reverse mortgages. Well, reverse mortgages may be an appropriate option for some investors who probably have no other assets other than their home. People need to be very careful because it is, once you start on a reverse mortgage, there's really no turning back.
And you also mentioned 401k debit cards. Can you tell our arbitrators what those are?
Yes. 401k debit cards are actually a fairly new instrument that allows people to tap into their 401k. On a more traditional basis, people could typically take what's called a 401k loan. The difference with the debit card is it allows you to set amount for your loan. That money is put into a money market fund, and then you can use a debit card to draw down on that loan. A couple of issues with that is typically there is an extra margin on that loan, so it's a more expensive option for you. Also, there are typically other fees attached to using the debit card. For example, anytime you use a debit card at an ATM machine, typically you're going to get charged for that. The other danger with the debit card is simply, you know, it makes it much easier to draw on that loan. Just think about people using plastic today. What do they buy with plastic? Lattes and pizzas. And so we're very concerned that the debit card will lead to people making unfortunate decisions of drawing down their 401k and using it for purposes other than retirement. Really, your 401k should be your last resort for taking funds out in almost any instance. And we're just afraid that the debit card makes it too easy to tap into that.
Thank you. Laura, you've already suggested that we're going to see a lot more cases relating to seniors with the baby boomer population. I know from our data that somewhere between 2011 and thereafter, people over 65 will account for 20% of the U.S. population. In addition to those kinds of cases, what else, when you look at your magic eight ball, do you foresee?
Well, one thing that I think we'll continue to see more of is what we saw with the auction rate securities, for example, which is the retailization of complex products that had previously been bought and sold primarily in the institutional markets, but that are now being marketed and aimed at retail investors, not just seniors, but all retail investors. And an example of that could be hedge funds. That's a product that normally is involves the institutional investors, but particularly with the evolution of funds of hedge funds, we see more retail involvement in that market. And one of the problems is that the recent credit squeeze has prompted several hedge funds to freeze investor redemptions. Some hedge funds have liquidated or even dissolved, and others have simply suffered significant losses. And customers who bought hedge funds or funds of hedge funds from brokerage firms may file claims alleging fraud or misrepresentation.
Thank you. And John, I know that the Supreme Court just came out with an important decision relating to 401ks. How might that impact the arbitration forum and the kinds of cases arbitrators hear?
On February 21st, the United States Supreme Court ruled that employees could sue their employers and their 401k administrator over mismanagement of their 401k plans. The ruling contradicts long-standing precedent holding that individual employees had no standing under ERISA to sue for mismanagement of a retirement plan. Broker-dealers administer many 401k plans, and registered representatives and associated persons arbitrate disputes with their employers. So that could lead to more arbitration claims.
And also, I guess, the limitations that both Congress and the courts have placed on class actions, how might that impact the arbitration forum?
Well, courts have recently refused to either certify or have decertified classes involving securities. Some courts have stated that investor claims arising out of allegedly false and misleading analyst reports were fact-intensive as to the loss causation and reliance and not suitable for class treatment. Most investors receive only a small recovery when class actions settle, often only a few cents on the dollar. Investors may increasingly turn to arbitration instead of participating in class actions.
And in fact, we're seeing that happen in many instances where lawyers are recommending on their websites that investors file arbitration claims rather than participate in class actions on the theory that an investor may well recover more of his or her losses in an arbitration than through a class action. Okay. One thing we have been very concerned about at FINRA is the emergence of new products. I mean, new products are important and innovation is really important, but we are concerned about how these new products are sold to investors. Laura, perhaps you can tell us a bit about that and about how we go about taking a look at these.
Yes, our office is, we do spend a fair amount of time trying to track and monitor new products that are coming out into the marketplace. As you mentioned, Linda, innovation is encouraged. It's an important part of the business. But some of these products that are being rolled out are very complex, very difficult to understand, certainly by the investors who may not understand all of the various risks and the fees associated with them. But even for some of the reps who are selling them may not fully understand what exactly it is they are selling. So what we're doing, a few years ago, we sat down with member firms and found out what processes they had in place for vetting new products, and in particular making sure that when a new product is rolled out that the reps understand what they're selling and that they know for whom generally it is suitable and for whom generally it is not suitable. We issued a best practices notice, I believe it was 0526, with best practices for firms that are introducing new products. We are also monitoring the emergence of new products on an ongoing basis. We're particularly looking for complex or exotic products, as I said, that are marketed to the retail customer. So we sit down, we meet periodically with firms to find out what they're developing. We have an internal task force that of our economists and other analysts here at FINRA that maintains a new products database. And when we see something of concern, often John's group will prepare an investor alert, and sometimes they find the product and bring it to us. So it works both ways, but we try to bring attention to the public when we find something we think is of concern.
Well, thank you. I'd like now to tell our arbitrators a bit about the Investor Education Foundation, essentially what it is, how it gets funded, and some of the grants that have been issued, particularly a couple of grants relating to arbitration. John?
The foundation was created in 2004 and is funded from two sources. First, from FINRA fine money that we receive, and secondly, from fine money through the Global Research Analyst Settlement that regulators reached with a number of securities firms. We believe that the Investor Education Foundation is the largest investor education foundation in the United States. And it focuses on providing innovative research and education to investors so that they're better able to understand the markets and the basic principles of saving and investing. And as I said, we work through grant making and through targeted programs. So for example, our newest targeted program is a program to help protect older investors. This is a really research-intensive project that focuses on creating a social norm campaign to measurably reduce senior susceptibility to investment fraud. We teach people, older people, to know that they're vulnerable. For example, our research discovered that it was counterintuitive who is the likely victim of investment fraud. It's typically a male, college-educated, highly financially literate, high income, typically overly optimistic and very self-reliant, and they've typically had some negative life events. I think that surprises a lot of people. So we try to target those individuals through this education program. And what we try to focus...
Maybe the same people who won't stop and ask for directions when they're lost in their car.
Exactly. we try to teach them, instead of what's the latest fraud or scam that is out there, what are the common persuasion tactics that are used in virtually every fraud that's out there. For example, let me give you one example. Scarcity. For example, many fraudsters will say there's only two products left, or you only have, if you don't reach me today, all the product will be sold. It's teaching people to identify those techniques and then take some simple protective steps, which are basically asking questions of the person that's trying to attempt to defraud them, and then checking that information out with regulators like FINRA. We found in doing research on this that people who had been through this persuasion curriculum had a 50% less chance of being taken by a fraud. Also, those people who had been through this persuasion curriculum asked twice as many questions as people who had not been through it, which we think helps insulate them from being defrauded.
John, could you mention the couple of grants that have been arbitration related?
Sure. We have funded two grants that focus on the arbitration area. The first one was to Northwestern University Law School to do two things: to establish the first securities arbitration clinic in the Midwest, and to create a guide to help other law schools establish securities arbitration clinics easily and provide them with guidance to do that from other clinics that had already been established. The clinic at Northwestern is already up and running, and we are about to finish work on the guide. So hopefully that will lead to more clinics being established.
Now, will that guide be posted on our website?
Yes. I mean, one thing with respect to the foundation is virtually every piece of research that we do and every program that we do is on the foundation's website, which is www.finrafoundation.org. So a lot of the research, which may be of interest to arbitrators, is there, as well as information on the Northwestern grant. The other grant that we funded was to Pace University Law Center, which was to develop an investor guide to dispute resolution. And we hope that this will be used by arbitration clinics and others around the country to make sure that investors understand what the process is to resolve their disputes. We think that clinics serve a very important education function as well as a representation function, because many of the people that go to clinics find out that you know, their problem may not be something that can be resolved through dispute resolution or through a complaint.
We also think that pamphlet, I've taken a look at the current draft, will aid investors in trying to figure out what course they want to take to resolve a problem they have with their broker, but also aid lawyers who are handling cases perhaps for the first or second time who are not experienced in the forum. So we're looking forward to the publication of this pamphlet. We think it'll serve multi-purposes. One of the most significant programs that the foundation has carried on relates to helping those people serving in our military who have been involved in issues relating to their finances and their investments. John, can you tell us about the military program, which I know we started in February of 2006?
Yes. Our military financial education program is really focused on first, strengthening quality programs that already existed, empowering the military community to take control of their financial futures, and then just increasing awareness of all the resources that are out there for them. And in fact, what we've tried to do is combine all financial resources for the military on a single website, www.savinginvest.org. This contains information not only from FINRA, but from the SEC, the Federal Reserve, the Federal Trade Commission, as well as many nonprofits, but all the information is objective and unbiased. We've also developed a number of resources for the military. For example, we provide a training program for the personal financial managers that are on virtually every base. We also provide an opportunity for military spouses to obtain a financial counseling program. All we ask in turn for them is that they provide counseling to other military families and to their own. We've also just recently launched a new online credit management tool. One of the issues in the military is predatory lending, and more specifically, payday loans. We'd like to see more folks in the military start to use traditional financial institution resources. So by providing them with an online credit management tool, we've been able to increase their credit scores so they had an opportunity to work with traditional financial institutions and also have lower interest rates on many of their loans. 37,000 service members have been through that program. We've also developed a program for the severely injured and wounded service members. Many of them receive significant lump sums as a result of their injuries or wounds. And as you might imagine, they're young and may not make the best use of that money. So we've developed a program working with the military hospitals to help guide them in how to best save and invest that money. We're also very much on the ground, and have done 64 events around the world, including aboard the USS Ronald Reagan in the Persian Gulf. We've reached, through our events, over 15,000 service members in less than 3 years. You know, it is terrific to go out and work and meet the individuals that are serving our country. Finally, I mean, we have developed an extensive online public awareness campaign, because if you develop content and no one goes to it, it's not very useful. So the good thing about working with the military is we get to work with the Department of Defense, which gives us access to the American Forces Network. Our public awareness TV commercials are seen during the Super Bowl, because on the military channels there are no commercials. So we have wide visibility in the military community. And I encourage anybody who's interested in our program to visit our website, savinginvest.org.
Yes, I must say that has been one of the most rewarding things that FINRA has done with the funds that are in the foundation. And we continue to look for worthy endeavors to make use of that money. I mean, which leads me to my next question, John, which are some of your recent grants and areas of focus. Maybe you could describe a couple of those.
Sure. One area, a new grant-making opportunity for us, is we partnered with the American Library Association to develop a grant program that we call Smart Investing at Your Library. And what that program did is, rather than creating new investor education and financial education content, was used to use public libraries, which are in virtually every community in the United States, to serve as a distribution mechanism for content that we developed, our grantees developed, or others to develop. In its first year, we gave grants to 13 libraries for a total of $850,000, And these are some of the most creative grants that we've given to date. For example, a library system in Illinois has developed a virtual library in Second Life. They also have a mobile library that's filled with technology that goes around to their library system and giving people access to some of the resources that have been developed through foundation grants. In March of 2008, we hope to expand our relationship. We are expanding our relationship with the American Library Association to conduct a second round of grant making, and we've already invited 300 libraries to participate in that program.
And then I guess one of the things that some of our arbitrators as well as other investors are not aware of are the many tools that FINRA has made available on its website. We have also just redesigned our website to make access to it and negotiating it much, much easier. John, perhaps you can describe the redesign and the kinds of tools that are available for arbitrators and investors and anyone else on our website to help them with all their various kinds of investments and decisions they have to make.
As Linda said, we've completely redesigned our site, and I think we've really improved the navigation and layout of the entire site, and I'd offer you to go visit it today if you can. It's much more clearly laid out, and it's easier to find resources. The web is probably the primary way we reach investors, and in fact, we've been fairly successful in the past several years, with a nearly 250% increase in the number of visitors coming to the investor information section of the FINRA site. We're now averaging over 500,000 visits per month. So we really try to do that. But what really drives a lot of the traffic to our website is, as Linda mentioned, our tools. And probably one of the top tools that you'll find on our website is our mutual fund and exchange-traded fund analyzer, which allows people to look up fund expenses on more than 18,000 funds and ETFs. All they need to know is the fund name and punch in some very easy information, the holding period, rate of return, the amount of money, and it will calculate the expenses over from 1 year to 20 years and give them information with respect to breakpoints and other information. Oh, this is one of our most widely used tools. Since its launch, over 2 million funds have been compared. Another important tool that drives traffic to our site is our market data center, which actually has real-time data on mutual funds, stocks, options, and bonds, including trace data from FINRA. So that's a really terrific tool for investors to use and allows them to come back. We also have a number of what we call smart investing learning centers, and these learning centers provide detailed information on several areas, on 401k investing, on smart bonds, and our latest one will be on managing your retirement income, which is becoming a much more important issue as Laura mentioned, the baby boom ages. We really think that needs to be an important focus of our investor education program moving forward.
So, thank you. And again, I encourage all of you to look at the various websites that we have referred to today. Well, I want to thank Laura and John for sharing their knowledge with all of you. And I want to say to all of you who participated in today's call and to all the arbitrators who could not make today's call, we recognize that we face great challenges in the next couple of years in running an efficient and cost-effective arbitration and mediation forum. We've positioned ourselves to meet that challenge in a number of important ways. This weekend, we completed essentially the termination, if you will, of Craftus. Craftus was our case management system. It was developed in the late 80s, and needless to say, over the years, it got a little rusty to handle our ever-growing caseload. Matrix is now totally complete, up and running, and other than a technical platform change in a few months, we're really delighted with the flexibility that our new computer case management system gives us. And we think it will enhance your abilities as well to deal with us in our mushrooming caseload. The second, a few years ago, we created a whole new business process so that we would have a lot more agility and flexibility, particularly in terms of caseloads going up and down. We think we've positioned ourselves for handling a caseload that may grow two or three times what it was last year without having to create a huge number of additional employees or temporary employees or infrastructure. So we're very pleased with the steps we've taken in the last few years to meet these challenges of managing a caseload that does change from year to year. Again, thanks to all of you who have participated. We think these are valuable learning tools. We would like to hear from you by email as to what kinds of subjects you would like us to include in the future. You'll recall that the last workshop we did, we had two experienced arbitrators sharing some of their experiences with you in handling difficult cases. The time before that, our in-house legal counsel advised with respect to arbitrators who are subpoenaed for information or face legal challenges as a result of their service as a FINRA arbitrator. Today we asked Laura and John to fill you in on some of the parts of FINRA that does such significant work that relates a lot to what we ask you as arbitrators to do, but is less known. Because our arbitrator disclosure reports don't list these workshops, you do not need to send us updates to us stating that you attended today's workshop. And after today's call, we will send an email containing a downloadable link. The link allows you to listen to a free replay of today's workshop. We also will have an audio recording on our website. Again, that's www.finra.org. And you go to the Arbitration and Mediation tab on the homepage, and that will bring you to all the valuable information. We hope you enjoyed today's workshop and found it innovative. Our next call will take place this winter. And once again, please make frequent trips to our website for the most up-to-date information from FINRA generally and from FINRA dispute resolution. Thank you very much, and that concludes our workshop for today.